history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories just waiting to be told if we take the time to ask a few questions and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to meet a gentleman today who is 99 years old. You'd never guess it by looking at him or shaking his hand. Frank Costa of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Geneva, New York, is our guest today. So, Frank, I got to hear about this. Growing up in upstate New York in the 20s and 30s with two brothers and a sister, your parents were both immigrants from Italy, is that right?
Correct.
So what was that childhood like?
Our life seemed to be around scouting. We did a lot of scouting in the small town. There was nothing else to do. But my parents had a grocery store in between scouting and the grocery store. We were camping someplace around the lake, Seneca Lake.
What a pretty part of the country, especially in the spring and fall.
It is a beautiful part. The three boys were all in scouting. I was an Eagle Scout. My brother was a Life Scout. Scouting was part of our life.
What did you get out of that?
I don't know. I guess it was always doing something. You're learning about the outside. You were going outside all the time. When I wasn't working in the store, I was out running a scout troop. And scouting to us was second to none, I guess. It's not like here. Back east, scouting is very strong. But here in Las Vegas, I don't find them. They have scout troops, but they're not like the troops we had.
Well, and the times have sure changed. That's 99 years is a long time to be alive, and I know you're looking forward to number 100 next year. You mentioned working in the store. How young were you when you started working in your folks' grocery store?
Wearing diapers.
Were you counting pennies or what?
No, she set me on the floor and said, put these over there, and I pick up the stuff and put them on the shelf. When we were growing up in the store. Then when I graduated from school, I bought a grocery store in the heart of town, and that was in 1937. And I stayed there until Uncle Sam called me. Then I turned over to my sister while I was gone, and she was running my dad's store, working with my dad. So then after the war was over, I came back, worked in the store with her, and then I said, I'm going to California. I says, the store is yours. I turned the store over to her, and I came to California, and I stayed here, which means I've been married for 69 years.
Yeah, you just lost your wife, Lena, a couple years ago, and of course it was a girl that brought you out west. But you never would have had a chance to meet that girl, or marry her anyway, if you didn't survive World War II. And I'm curious, too, being in that family grocery business during the Great Depression, I bet you witnessed some things that gave you a little perspective. What do you remember about those years in the 1930s when so many people faced hard times?
You don't notice the hard time as long as people work together. I used to have people come by the grocery store and say, can I have a bologna end? And if the guy asked you, and I'd say, just come on, cut a couple slices of bologna, you would give it to him, think nothing of it. Then you'd get another guy come in and says, hey, you got something you can give me? And you say, I'm sorry, the boss is gone. But most of the guys come in real nice. Most of them wanted a cigarette or a bologna end. They didn't ask for anything big. That's all they wanted. They go down the thing, and I asked one man, I said, why do you guys always pick up my store? Yet there's a grocery store next door, and the store's above me. He says, because when we come to the town, we mark who's good and who isn't. And that's why they come to your store.
They knew you had a generous heart.
They had it marked down on the sidewalk with chalk.
Wow.
And they would come in and be nice, and they got a piece of bologna.
I guess so.
Or a hot dog or whatever they wanted. And Dad always says, always feed somebody because he can starve to death. It might not be his fault.
Everyone that I've talked to who was alive during this time period seems to remember something about December 7th, 1941. So you were already out of school. You're working the grocery store. What do you remember about that day?
The college was having a party that night. They had been planning it. And they wanted a keg of beer, and they came over to order the beer, and they were supposed to pick it up that morning. They didn't pick it up. They came in and says, Hold the Bear, we're going to enlist.
Wow.
And a whole bunch of kids from Hawaii College enlisted in on that day. Cancel my order.
It affected business on December 7th. Did you have an idea at that point that it was going to affect your life or the lives of your brothers?
No. I had no idea. But I do remember my dad saying this. We were at the dinner table, and he says, "Boys, I want to say something. You have relatives in Italy, but you are an American, and we will probably be fighting Italy." And he says, "Forget them." He said, "This is your country."
Wow.
My dad told me that. So that was the thing I remembered at the table. And I didn't think anything more of it. I went along with my business. They drafted my brother in the first draft. He stayed the whole 5 years in Europe. That was in when the war broke out in 41. And in 42, my younger brother was going to get drafted, but he didn't want to be an Army, so he went enlisted in the Navy. And they deferred me because I had the business, and he couldn't take two in the same family at the same time. Then about 6 months later, they drafted me. And that's when I realized, hey, I'm in this. So my sister said, "I'll take over the store. When you come back, you can take it." Mm. He said, "Fine." So my dad says, between the three of us, as mother, dad, and sister, the three boys in the service now. Everybody said, "It's not fair. They're taking the cost of boys. They should leave one of them at home and all that stuff." And my dad said, "If they want the boys will go." Mm. So I went into service in April of 43.
Did you get a sense for how difficult that was on your parents and your sister to have all three of you gone and with your lives in danger?
You don't think of that at the time. You think, well, when am I going to get out?
Mm-hmm.
So my dad says, like he told us before, well, you do the best you can when you go anyplace.
You mentioned your father's statement about, we have relatives still in Italy, but you guys are Americans. A lot of people today don't realize that there was an effort by the government to keep Italian Americans away from that theater. And there were also camps where Italian Americans were sent, much like Japanese Americans on the West Coast. They were actually held prisoner by their government for a while. It's so unfathomable for us today. Were you aware of any of that at the time?
No.
Isn't that kind of crazy to think of?
Yeah.
But here your father made it very clear whose side you guys are on.
Yeah.
So you had to tank destroyer school.
No, first I went to quartermaster school because I had a grocery store. While I was there, they made me a warrant officer.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't buy being a warrant officer. As the old Army says, that's a bastard of the outfit. Me being a good little Italian boy, a good Catholic boy, when this is a bastard to me, that's not me. So I didn't want to, I said, I don't want to be a warrant officer. So they sent me to the tank destroyer school.
Uh-huh.
I graduated and they sent me to San Luis Obispo in January of 44. So they sent me to join the 81st Wildcats. And from there, we went to Fort Roberts, picked up our tanks, and then went to Marysville, California for our training session.
Mm-hmm.
From there, we went to Hawaii, and I became lifeguard on Waikiki Beach.
Tough job.
Well, the guys were training. I wasn't getting any training. So then we get the ship out, and the captain says to me, he said, "Get your gear ready because we're shipping out." I said, "Where are we going?" He said, "We're going." And I said, "But I haven't had any training." And he said, "I forgot about you." So they got the teachers, brought us on the aft of the ship, showed me all the jungle training we're supposed to have. Then we made the dry run on Guadalcanal.
I want you to flesh this out a little bit because, I mean, it sounds kind of crazy these days to think about what they're sending you into with no preparation whatsoever. But when your outfit, the 81st Infantry Division, is in Hawaii to train to go to the Pacific, you end up a lifeguard on Waikiki Beach.
Correct.
Didn't have to do any military training at all.
No.
How'd you pull that off?
I was a lifeguard before I was in the service, in the scouting. Then when I got to Marysville, I became a lifeguard in Marysville Pool, training the guys to jump off the high dive, like jumping off of a high ship.
Uh-huh.
And that was my job, is teach a guy doesn't break his neck with a strap from the helmet.
Sure.
And they're jumping from off the high board, which is 20, 30 feet in the air. My job is to teach them. That's all I was doing.
I can't imagine a better Army job than lifeguard on Waikiki Beach.
No, that was the best.
You never had to save the Duke, did you?
No, but I had the pleasure of telling the colonel to get off the beach.
Oh, yeah? How'd that happen?
This girl happened to be a friend of mine in Geneva. When I was on lifeguard, he said, "Hey, Frank," I'm over, and he shook hands. And then he finally says, "How about having lunch with me?" I said, "Sure, great." I didn't know anything about rules and regulations. So after I got off shift at 12 o'clock, I walk over to the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, and he saw me, and he says, "You're a private?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "I can't eat with you." I said, "Okay, goodbye." And I turned around, walked back, kind of teetered me off. So the next afternoon, here he comes down, strutting down in his swimming suit to the NCO's beach. I blow my whistle. I says, "Hey, you're off the wrong beach." And I run the car. He went home and he told my parents about it.
Oh, that's funny. Well, hey, it was the NCO beach. He's got his own beach, right?
Right.
So you're doing this lifeguard stuff, and then the 81st is getting ready to ship out, and you say, "Wait, I don't know what I'm doing."
Right.
So they train you actually on the ship heading over.
Going on a dry run means pretend of war.
Yeah.
So we hit the beach at Guadalcanal.
Because that had already been secured by American forces.
Right.
But you guys do a mock invasion just to practice.
Correct.
So what was your role in that?
I just, with my tank is all.
Uh-huh.
I just went in with my tank, did my job. Then we come back on and the captain says, "Sharpen up your tools." He says, "The real McCoy is coming." So we got ready, and just a few days later, we were hitting the beach.
And what kind of tank was this? How many guys would be on a crew for that tank?
I think it was 7 of us.
And what was your job inside that tank?
At that time, I was handling the ammunition, and then I was on the outside calling in. When we hit the beach the first time, I was outside the tank. We come off the beach, and we have to hit the railroad track, which was built on a mound, to going up to the phosphate plant. So my driver says, "We'll take the high road, and we'll direct Abel Company, Baker Company on our side, be our bodyguards, like."
Mm-hmm.
So we start going up, but as we're going up here like this here, we're a little faster than the jungle going through all that coral rock. So we started to get ahead of them.
Mm.
And then when we got ahead of them, they thought it was Japanese up ahead fighting. They ordered firing for the head squad where we were. And our own troops started firing at us.
Ooh.
It's about that time the airplanes, Japs coming across, and one of them is coming down. You get the machine gun. You could see the dust coming up off of the railroad track. And that's when I jump over the side of the tracks off the tank, maybe 15 or 20 feet down. And two other kids went down with me, one from Abel Company. One was a blonde kid, I remember him. And he landed in front of me. I was in the center, and this other kid on the left side against the tree. I lost my helmet because I was talking on the phone. And I just rubbed my head, and I said, "Oh, God, not in the head. Please don't let me get hit in the head." We hit the bottom of the thing. The kid against the tree got shrapnel in the helmet. He didn't die. The medics picked him up. And I didn't get a scratch on me. And the kid in front of me got a hit in the chest, which killed him outright.
Wow.
The medics were there. And one guy says to me, he said, "God was on your side." I says, "Yep, I'm going to be lived to 103 after that." And that's where the 103 come out.
Well, and you're just 4 years away. So I want everyone to understand what we're talking about here. This is your very first taste of combat.
Right.
The first few minutes and first hour of your combat. This is the landing at Angar.
Angara.
So this is part of the Palau chain. You guys hit a bunch of islands. But your very first taste of combat, you're going in with the tanks. You get out in front. So your own guys are firing at you, and then Japanese planes start strafing you.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you dive off the side of a tank, but right. This is an embankment or something? Or
yeah.
You fall a long way.
About 18 feet.
Now that in itself could kill you.
Yeah.
You lose your helmet, and the machine gun bullets are still coming in.
Yeah.
It kills one guy next to you, the other guy gets hit in the helmet.
The bomb hit the front of the tank, and shrapnel hit us all around us.
So one of the Japanese planes bombed the tank, mm-hmm. destroyed the tank.
Right.
Wounded one guy next to you, killed the other guy.
Right.
You don't have a helmet, but you don't have a scratch.
Right.
I'd say that guy was right. I think God was on your side. But how do you handle that at the time?
You're not thinking of anything, but keep going. As soon as the medics got rid of me, I was going back to my tank. They disabled that tank, and then so I had to go to another tank, and yeah, that was a rough day.
Well, yeah, and that sounds like that was just the beginning of the day.
Yeah.
So what happened after that? What was the rest of that day like?
We got up to the trellis as far as the top of the hill, and then we saw the phosphate plant. We didn't know it was there, but then we set camp right there, so watching the phosphate plant. Well, Abel Company and Baker Company surrounded it. We stood guard over top, and as they needed fire, we directed fire. Then that evening come in, and that was the scary part.
Why was that?
You didn't know what was out there. It's all so black.
And this is a brand new experience for you. Never been in combat before. Did you sleep at all that night?
Nobody slept.
Not at all?
No.
What goes through your mind while you're sitting there in the dark?
Hope nobody comes over the top of that thing. You got your gun ready all the time. The coral rock was so hard you couldn't even dig a thing, so we got under our tanks, you know, to hide out.
Yikes.
Too bad, too much.
Well, yeah, you have shared with me that when the war ended, you put it away. I mean, you came home, you got to work. This is not something that you've dwelt upon for the last 70-plus years.
No, but it's coming back.
Well, and I know your recent trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada triggered a flood of memories coming back. I'm very thankful you're willing to take us to some of those places today. When Frank said too much, he meant too much was coming back, and it was just too tough to talk about. I think it's a good time to take our first break. When we come back, we're going to hear more about his experiences in the invasion of Angar Island. And if you want to get an even more thorough picture, go to hometownheroesradio.com because I have a film the War Department shot with the 81st Infantry Division on Angar in 1944. You'll see the action that Frank's describing, and I think you'll better understand why it's so difficult to talk about. We're going to hear about the time he says he would have been dead if he had been in his usual spot in his tank. And we'll also hear how he met the young lady who would become his wife. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.